Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, narrated by Simon Slater.
2 days later, he's alone with Anne. She is tucked into a window embrasure, eyes closed, basking like a cat in a scarce shaft of winter sun. She stretches out her hand to him, hardly knowing who he is. Any man will do. He takes her fingertips. Her black eyes snap open. It's like a shop when the shutters are taken down. Good morning, Master Cromwell. What can we sell each other today? I am tired of Mary, she says, and I would like to be rid of her. Does she mean Catherine's daughter, the princess? She should be married, she says, and out of my way. I never want to have to see her. I don't want to have to think about her. I have long imagined her married to some obscure person. He waits, still wondering. I don't suppose she would be a bad wife for somebody who was prepared to keep her chained to the wall. Ah, Mary, your sister. What did you think? Oh, she laughs. You thought I meant Mary the king's bastard. Well, now you put it in my mind. She should be married too. What age is she?
17 this year.
And still a dwarf.
Anne doesn't wait for an answer.
I shall find some old gentleman for her, some very honourable, feeble old gentleman, who will get no children on her, and whom I will pay to stay away from court. But as for Lady Carey, what is to be done? She cannot marry you. We tease her that you are her choice. Some ladies have a secret preference for common men. We say, Mary, oh, how you long to repose in the arms of the blacksmith. Even at the thought you are growing hot.
Are you happy? He asks her.
Yes.
She drops her eyes, and her small hands rest on her ribcage.
Yes, because of this, you see, she says slowly. I was always desired, but now I am valued. And that is a different thing, I find.
He pauses, to let her think her own thoughts, which he sees are precious to her.
So, she says, you have a nephew Richard, a Tudor of sorts, though I am sure I cannot understand how that came about.
I can draw out for you the tree of descent. She shakes her head, smiling.
I wouldn't give you the trouble. Since this,
her fingers slip downwards,
I wake up in the morning. I scarcely remember my name. I always wondered why women were foolish, and now I know.
You mentioned my nephew.
I have seen him with you. He looks a determined boy. He might do for her. What she wants are furs and jewels. You can give her those, can't you? And a child in the cradle every other year. As for who fathers it, you can make your own household arrangements about that.
I thought, he says, that your sister had an attachment. He doesn't want revenge, just clarification.
Does she? Oh, well, Mary's attachments, usually passing and sometimes very odd, as you know, don't you?
It's not a question.
Bring them to court, your children. Let's see them.
He leaves her, eyes closing again, edging into marginal warmth, the small sort of sunbeam that is all February offers. The king has given him lodgings within the old palace at Westminster, for when he works too late to get home. This being so, he has to walk mentally through his rooms at Austin Friars, picking up his memory images from where he has left them on windowsills and under stools and in the woolen petals of the flowers strewn in the tapestry at Anselma's feet. At the end of a long day, he takes supper with Cranmer and with Roland Lee, who stamps between the various working parties, urging them along. Sometimes Audley joins them, the Lord Chancellor, but they keep no state, just sit down like a bunch of inky students, and talk till it's Cranmer's bedtime. He wants to work them out, these people, test how far he can rely on them, and find out their weaknesses. Audley is a prudent lawyer who can sift a sentence like a cook sifting a sack of rice for grit. An eloquent speaker, he is tenacious of a point and devoted to his career. Now that he's Chancellor, he aims to make an income to go with the office. As for what he believes, it's up for negotiation. He believes in Parliament, in the King's power, exercised in Parliament, and in matters of faith, let's say his convictions are flexible. As for Lee, he wonders if he believes in God at all, though it doesn't stop him having a bishopric in his sights. He says, "Roland, will you take Gregory into your household? I think Cambridge has done all that it can for him, and I admit that Gregory has done nothing for Cambridge."
"I'll take him up the country with me," Roland says, "when I go to have a row with the northern bishops. He is a good boy, Gregory. Not the most forward, but I can understand that. We'll make him useful yet."
"You don't intend him for the church?"
Cranmer asks.
"I said," growls Roland, "we'll make him useful." At Westminster, his clerks are in and out with news and gossip and paperwork, and he keeps Christoph with him, supposedly to look after his clothes, but really to make him laugh. He misses the music they have nightly at Austin Friars, and the women's voices, heard from other rooms. He is at the Tower most days of the week, persuading the foremen to keep their men working through frost and rain, checking the paymaster's accounts, and making a new inventory of the King's jewels and plate. He calls on the wardens of the Mint, and suggests a spot check on the weight of the King's coinage. "What I should like to do," he says, "is make our English coins so sound that the merchants over the sea won't even bother weighing them."
"Do you have authority for this?"
"Why? What are you hiding?" He has written a memorandum for the King, setting out the sources of his yearly revenues, and detailing through which government offices they pass. It is remarkably concise. The King reads it and reads it again. He turns the paper over to see if anything convoluted and inexplicable is written on the back. But there is nothing more than meets his eye. "It's not news," he says, half apologetic. "The late Cardinal carried it in his head. I shall keep calling at the Mint, if your Majesty pleases." At the Tower, he calls on a prisoner, John Frith. At his request, which does not count for nothing, the prisoner is cleanly kept above ground with warm bedding, sufficient food, a supply of wine, paper, ink, though he has advised him to put away his writing if he hears the key in his lock. He stands by while the turnkey admits him, his eyes on the ground, not liking what he's going to see. But John Frith rises from his table, a gentle, slender young boy, a scholar in Greek, and says, "Master Cromwell, I knew you would come." When he takes Frith's hands, he finds them all bones, cold and dry, and with telltale traces of ink. He thinks, he cannot be so delicate, if he's lived so long. He was one of the scholars shut in the cellar at Wolsey's College, where the Bible men were held because there was no other secure place. When the summer plague struck underground, Frith lay in the dark with the corpses, till someone remembered to let him out. "Master Frith," he says, "if I had been in London when you were taken..."
"But while you were in Calais, Thomas More was at work."
"What made you come back into England? No, don't tell me. If you were going about Tyndale's work, I'd better not know it. They say you've taken a wife, is that correct? In Antwerp?" "The one thing the King cannot abide..." "No, many things he cannot abide. But he hates married priests. And he hates Luther, and you have translated Luther into English. You put the case so well, for my prosecution. You must help me to help you. If I could get you an audience with the King, you would have to be prepared. He is a most astute theologian. Do you think you could soften your answers to accommodate him?" The fire is built up, but the room is still cold. You cannot get away from the mists and exhalations of the Thames. Frith says, his voice barely audible,
"Thomas More still has some credit with the King, and he has written him a letter saying,"
he manages to smile,
"that I am Wycliffe, Luther, and Zwingli rolled together and tied up in string, one reformer stuffed inside another, as for a feast you might parcel a pheasant inside a chicken, inside a goose. More means to dine on me, so do not injure your credit by asking for mercy. As for softening my answers, I believe,
and I will say before any tribunal.
Do not, John.
I will say before any tribunal what I will say before my last judge. The Eucharist is but bread. Of penance we have no need. Purgatory is an invention ungrounded in Scripture.
If some men come to you and say, Come with us, Frith, you go with them. They will be my men.
You think you can take me out of the tower?
Tyndale's Bible says, With God shall nothing be impossible. If not out of the tower, then when you are taken to be questioned, that will be your chance. Be ready to take it.
But to what purpose?
Frith speaks kindly, as if speaking to a young pupil.
You think you can keep me at your house and wait for the king to change his mind? I should have to break out of there and walk to Paul's Cross and say, before the Londoners, what I've already said.
Your witness cannot wait.
Not on Henry. I might wait till I was old.
They will burn you.
And you think I cannot bear the pain? You are right, I cannot. But they will give me no choice. As Moore says, it hardly makes a man a hero to agree to stand and burn once he is chained to a stake. I have written books, and I cannot unwrite them. I cannot unbelieve what I believe. I cannot unlive my life.
He leaves him. 4 o'clock. The river traffic sparse, a fine and penetrative vapour creeping between air and water. Next day, a day of crisp blue cold, the king comes down in the royal barge to see the progress of the work with the new French envoy. They are confidential, the king walking with a hand on de Danteville's shoulder, or rather on his padding. The Frenchman is wearing so many layers that he seems broader than the doorways, but he's still shivering. "Our friend here must get some sport to warm his blood," the king says. "And he is a bungler with the bow. When we went into the butts last, he shook so much, I thought he would shoot himself in the foot. He complains we are not serious falconers, so I have said he shall go out with you, Cromwell." Is this a promise of time off? The king strolls away and leaves them.
"Not if it's cold like this," the envoy says. "I'm not standing in a field with the wind whistling. It will be the death of me. When shall we see the sun again?"
"Oh, about June. The falcons will be molting by then. I aim to have mine flying again in August, so nil desperanda, monsieur. We shall have some sport."
"You wouldn't postpone this coronation, would you?"
"It's always so. After a little chaff and chat, out of his mouth pops an ambassador's purpose.
Because when my master made the treaty, he didn't expect Henry to be flaunting his supposed wife and her big belly. If he were to keep her quietly, it would be a different matter."
He shakes his head. "There will be no postponement. Henry claims he has the support of the bishops, the nobles, judges, parliament, and the people. Anne's coronation is his chance to prove it."
"Never mind," he says. "Tomorrow we entertain the papal nuncio. You will see how my master will manage him."
Henry calls down to them from the walls.
"Come up here, sir. See the prospect of my river."
"Do you wonder I shake?"
the Frenchman says with passion.
"Do you wonder I tremble before him? My river, my city, my salvation, cut out and embroidered just for me? My personally tailored English god."
He swears under his breath and begins to climb. When the papal nuncio comes to Greenwich, Henry takes him by the hand and tells him frankly how his ungodly counsellors torment him, and how he longs for a return of perfect amity with Pope Clement. You could watch Henry every day for a decade and not see the same thing. Choose your prince. He admires Henry more and more. Sometimes he seems hapless, sometimes feckless, sometimes a child, sometimes master of his trade. Sometimes he seems an artist, in the way his eye ranges over his work. Sometimes his hand moves, and he doesn't seem to see it move. if he had been called to a lower station in life, he could have been a travelling player and leader of his troop. At Anne's command, he brings his nephew to court, Gregory, too. Ralph, the king, already knows, for he is always at his elbow. The king stands gazing for a long time at Richard.
"I see it. Indeed I do."
There is nothing in Richard's face, as far as he can see, to show that he has Tudor blood, but the king is looking at him with the eye of a man who wants relatives.
"Your grandfather, Ap Evan, the archer, was a great servant to the king, my father. You have a fine build. I should like to see you in the tilt-yard. I should like to see you carry your colours in the joust."
Richard bows, and then the king, because he is the essence of courtesy, turns to Gregory and says,
"And you, Master Gregory, you are a very fine young man too."
As the king walks away, Gregory's face opens in simple pleasure. He puts his hand on his arm, the place the king has touched, as if transferring regal grace to his fingertips.
"He's very splendid. He's so splendid, beyond anything I ever thought. And to speak to me!"
He turns to his father.
"How do you manage to speak to him every day?"
Richard gives him a sideways look. Gregory thumps him on the arm.
"Never mind your grandfather, the archer. What would he say if he knew your father was that big?"
He shows between finger and thumb the stature of Morgan Williams.
"I've been riding at the ring these many years. I've been riding at the Saracen's image and putting my lance just so, thud, right over his black Saracen's heart."
"Yes," Richard says patiently. "But, Squib, you will find a living knight a tougher proposition than a wooden infidel. You never think of the cost. Armour of show quality, a stable of trained horses."
"We can afford it," he says. "It seems our days as foot soldiers are behind us."
That night at Austin Friars, he asks Richard to come to speak with him alone after supper. Possibly he is at fault in putting it as a business proposition, spelling out to him what Anne has suggested about his marriage.
"Build nothing on it. We have yet to get the king's approval."
Richard says, "But she doesn't know me." He waits for objections.
"Not knowing someone, is that an objection?"
"I won't force you."
Richard looks up.
"Are you sure?"
When have I ever forced anyone to do anything?" he starts to say. But Richard cuts in.
"No, you don't. I agree. It's just that you are practiced at persuading, and sometimes it's quite difficult, sir, to distinguish being persuaded by you from being knocked down in the street and stamped on."
"I know Lady Carey is older than you, but she is very beautiful. I think the most beautiful woman at court. And she is not as witless as everyone thinks, and she has not got any of her sister's malice in her."
In a strange way, he thinks, she has been a good friend to me.
"And instead of being the king's unrecognised cousin, you would be his brother-in-law. We would all profit."
"A title, perhaps, for me and for you. Brilliant matches for Alice and Joe. What about Gregory? A countess at least for him."
Richard's voice is flat. Is he talking himself into it? It's hard to tell. With many people, most people perhaps, the book of their heart lies open to him. But there are times when it's easier to read outsiders than your own family.
"And Thomas Boleyn would be my father-in-law, and Uncle Norfolk would really be our uncle."
"Imagine his face."
"Oh, his face. Yes, one would go barefoot over hot coals to see his expression."
"Think about it. Don't tell anybody."
Richard goes out with a bob of the head, but without another word. It seems he interprets "don't tell anybody" as "don't tell anybody but Ralph," because 10 minutes later Ralph comes in and stands looking at him with his eyebrows raised. Red-headed people can look quite strange when they are raising eyebrows that aren't really there. He says,
"You need not tell Richard that Mary Boleyn once proposed herself to me. There's nothing between us. It won't be like Wolf Hall, if that's what you're thinking."
And what if the bride thinks different? I wonder you don't marry her to Gregory.
Gregory is too young. Richard is 23. It is a good age to marry if you can afford it. And you have passed it. It's time you married too. I'm going before you find a Boleyn for me.
Ralph turns back and says softly,
Only this, sir. And I think it is what gives Richard pause. All our lives and fortunes depend now on that lady. And as well as being mutable, she's mortal. And the whole history of the king's marriage tells us a child in the womb is not an heir in the cradle.
In March, news comes from Calais that Lord Berners has died. The afternoon in his library, the storm blowing outside. It seems when he looks back, a haven of peace, the last hour he had to himself. He wants to make an offer for his books, a generous one to help Lady Berners. But the folios seem to have jumped off their desks and walked. Some in the direction of Francis Bryan, the old man's nephew, and some to another connection of his, Nicholas Carew. "Would you forgive his debts?" he asks Henry. "At least for his wife's lifetime. You know he leaves. No sons." Henry's mind has moved ahead. "Once I was in that unhappy state, no sons, but soon I shall have my heir." He brings Anne some Majolica bowls. The word Maschio is painted on the outside, and inside are pictures of plump, blonde-haired babies, each with a coy little phallus. She laughs. The Italians say for a boy, you have to keep warm, he tells her. Heat up your wine to heat up your blood. No cold fruit, no fish. Jane Seymour says,
Do you think it's already decided what it will be, or does God decide later? Do you think it knows itself, what it is? Do you think if we could see inside you, we would be able to tell?
Jane, I wish you were still down in Wiltshire, Mary Shelton says.
Anne says,
You needn't cut me up, Mistress Seymour. It is a boy, and no one is to say or think otherwise.
She frowns, and you can see her bending, concentrating the great force of her will.
I'd like a baby, Jane says.
Watch yourself, Lady Rochford tells her. If your belly shows, mistress, we'll have you bricked up alive.
In her family, Anne says, they'd give her a bouquet. They don't know what continence means down at Wolf Hall.
Jane is flushed and trembling.
I meant no harm. Leave her, Anne says. It's like baiting a field mouse.
She turns to him.
Your bill is not passed yet. Tell me, what is the delay?
The bill, she means, to forbid appeals to Rome. He begins to explain to her the strength of the opposition, but she raises her eyebrows and says,
My father is speaking for you in the Lords, and Norfolk. So who dare oppose us?
I shall have it through by Easter, depend upon it.
The woman we saw in Canterbury, they say her people are printing a book of her prophecies.
That may be, but I shall make sure that no one reads it.
They say on St. Catherine's Day last, while we were at Calais, she saw a vision of the so-called Princess Mary crowned queen.
Her voice runs on, fluid, rapid. These are my enemies, this prophetess and those about her, Catherine, who is plotting with the Emperor, her daughter Mary, the supposed heir, Mary's old governess, Margaret Pole, Lady Salisbury, she and all her family are my enemies, her son, Lord Montague, her son, Reginald Pole, who is abroad. People talk of his claim to the throne, so why can he not be brought back, his loyalty examined? Henry Courtenay, the Marquis of Exeter, he believes he has a claim, but when my son is born, that will put him out of his conceit. Lady Exeter, Gertrude, she's forever complaining that noblemen are being put down from their places by men of low birth, and you know who she means by that.
My lady, her sister says softly, do not distress yourself.
I am not distressed, Anne says. Her hand over the growing child, she says calmly.
These people want me dead.
The days are still short, the king's temper shorter. Chapuis bows and writhes before him, twisting and grimacing, as if he had in mind to ask Henry to dance.
I have read with some perplexity certain conclusions reached by Dr. Cranmer.
My Archbishop, the King says coldly. At great expense, the anointing has taken place.
Conclusions regarding Queen Catherine.
Who? You mean my late brother's wife, the Princess of Wales?
For your Majesty knows that dispensations were issued in such form as to allow your own marriage to be valid, whether or no that former marriage was consummated.
I do not want to hear the word dispensation, Henry says. I do not want to hear you mention what you call my marriage. The Pope has no power to make incest licit. I am no more Catherine's husband than you are. Chapuis bows. If the contract had not been void, Henry says, patient for the last time, God would not have punished me with the loss of my children.
We do not know the Blessed Catherine is beyond childbearing.
He looks up with a sly, delicate glance. Tell me, why do you think I do this? The King sounds curious. Out of lust? Is that what you think? Kill a cardinal? Divide your country? Split the church?
It seems extravagant,
Chapuis murmurs. But that is what you think. That is what you tell the Emperor. You are wrong. I am the steward of my country, sir. And if I now take a wife in a union blessed by God, it is to have a son by her.
But there is no guarantee that your Majesty will have a son, or any living children at all.
Why would I not? Henry reddens. He is on his feet, shouting, angry tears spilling down his face. Am I not a man like other men? Am I not? Am I not? He is a game little terrier, the Emperor's man. But even he knows that when you've made a king cry, it's time to back off. On the way out, he says, dusting himself down with his accustomed self-deprecatory flutter.
There is a distinction to be drawn between the welfare of the country and the welfare of the Tudor line. Or do you not think so?
So who is your preferred candidate for the throne? You favour Courtney or Pole?
You should not sneer at persons of royal blood.
Chapuis shakes out his sleeves.
At least now I am officially informed of the lady's state, whereas before I could only deduce it from certain spectacles of folly I had witnessed. Do you know how much you are staking, Cromwell, on the body of one woman? Let us hope no evil comes nearer, eh?
He takes the ambassador by the arm, wheels him around. What evil? Say what you mean.
If you would let go your crepe on my jacket. Thank you. Very soon, you resort to manhandling people, which shows, as they say, your breeding.
His words are full of bravado, but he is trembling.
Look around you, and see how, by her pride and presumption, she offends your own nobility. Her own uncle has no stomach for her tricks. The king's oldest friends make excuses to stay away from court.
Wait till she's crowned, he says. Watch them come running. On the 12th of April, Easter Sunday, Anne appears with the king at High Mass and is prayed for as Queen of England. His bill went through Parliament just yesterday. He expects a modest reward. And before the royal party go in to break their fast, the king waves him over and gives him Lord Berners' old post, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Berners suggested you for it. Henry smiles. He likes giving. Like a child, he enjoys anticipating how pleased you will be. During Mass, his mind had wandered through the city. What noisome goose houses have they waiting for him at home? What rows in the street? What babies left on church steps? What unruly apprentices with whom he will please have a word? Have Alice and Joe painted Easter eggs? They are too grown up now. But they are content to be the children of the house until the next generation comes along. It's time he put his mind to husbands for them. Anne, if she had lived, could be married by now, and to Rafe, as he is still not spoken for. He thinks of Helen Barr, how fast she gets on with her reading, how they cannot do without her at Austin Friars.